We would be there to support him as long as he tried to be there for us. Vin swore he wasn't just along for the ride and promised to make an effort. Afterward, we played on the Monsters of Rock tour in Europe with AC/DC, Metallica, and Queensryche, and that was the first time that the shows didn't make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Though they had so many hits, they should have wiped almost every other band off the stage. Something was missing. They didn't feel real anymore, and the pre-recorded tapes they used to replace their backup singer sounded phony to the crowd. Back home, when Decade of Decadence came out, Nicky started spending half his nights at hotels because he was fighting with his wife. Vince, meanwhile, was off on a racing jag. It always seemed like a great little hobby for him, until some jerk-off in Long Beach convinced him to race on an Indy Lights team, where I was sure some driver was going to see this rock and roll asshole on the track and try to kill him. He started spending his weekends at race car conferences, where we'd hear reports that he'd been up all night drinking. I put them back in the studio in December 1991 on a two-week-on, two-week-off schedule. But every time I went down to visit, Vince wasn't there. He'd have left the studio after a few hours, claiming he was too tired to sing. Finally, in February, the band started to get pissed.
Chapter 3. Nicky. All that was once great is washed away in the rain. On Monday, the floods began. The waters swept over the Ventura Freeway, flooded the Sepulveda Basin, killed six people, and left hundreds more hanging on to telephone poles and antennas for their lives. On the radio, Governor Pete Wilson declared a state of emergency and said that we were in the midst of the worst storm of the century. That didn't matter, though, to Tommy and me. We drove for 2 hours to get to rehearsal in Burbank from Westlake Village while Mick, who was up in the mountains somewhere, had an even more grueling ride. We met in the studio lounge and waited for Vince. On the news, we watched people swimming out of their cars on Burbank Boulevard. 1 hour passed. 2 hours passed. 3 hours passed. 4 hours passed. We called Vince every half hour, but each time there was a busy signal. Because we had all driven through the storm just to go to rehearsal that day, the longer we had to wait for Vince, who only lived half the distance away that we did, the more pissed we became. This was a crucial album, the follow-up to the biggest success we had ever had, and he didn't seem to be taking it seriously. He had started taking Thursdays and Fridays off to go to the races, and would usually return late on Mondays. So every week, we'd only get at most 2.5 days of studio time because he was never there. Finally, we had Mike Amato, who had replaced Rich Fisher as our tour manager, send Vince a fax telling him to get his ass to rehearsal. 15 minutes later, the studio phone rang. "Man, I'm sorry," he said. "Where were you?" I asked. "We've been trying to call you for 4 hours. This is bullshit." "I know. The phone lines were down." That set me off. "The phone lines were down? Then how the fuck did the fax go through? You had the phone off the hook because you didn't want to fucking come in. All of us drove through floods to get here, and you couldn't even be bothered." "Dude, take it easy. I thought rehearsal was canceled anyway with the flooding and everything." "Well, it wasn't. Get your ass down here before we really get pissed." As we waited for him to come, someone in the studio said that he had seen Vince out completely wasted at 3 a.m. the previous night. Whether it was true or not, it didn't matter. The conversation had already taken on a mutinous tone. Except for Mick, we were all slipping off the wagon, but Vince was the only one who was letting it affect his work, who was getting caught all the time, and who was constantly lying about it. By the time he arrived, the seed was already planted in our minds that he was holding us back. Maybe if Vince had walked in and apologized for staying out so late the night before and sleeping through rehearsal, everything would have been fine, but he didn't. "What the fuck's going on?" Vince raged, as the lounge door flew open and he stood there soaked and sulking. "You know what?" I said. "We are having new lead singer talks again. We are down here working, and we want to be here. This isn't going to happen if you don't want to be here, and we have to force you out of bed every afternoon because you've been out all night drinking. Maybe I would come in more if I liked the material." "Well, you could have told somebody." Tommy couldn't keep quiet any longer. "Maybe you'd like the material better if you had come to the studio a few times to be part of making it. Every time you fucking come in, dude, you're staring at your watch the whole time because you need to go to a fucking golf tournament or racing school. What the fuck's up with that? I'm looking at my watch because I can't stand being here. The album is stupid. The keyboards you're putting on the album make us sound like pussies. Vince, we've been using keyboards since 83, I shot back. The bullshit flew back and forth like a game of tennis until he finally threw his racket into the net. I'm not going to stay here and listen to this bullshit, he yelled at us. I'm fucking out of here. I quit. He stormed off toward the door and looked back. Call me if you ever change your fucking mind. He says he was fired. I say he quit. Either way, his head was on the chopping block, and he gave us a good excuse to lower the axe. Now that I look back on it, we were fried. We had toured nonstop behind Feel Good and Decade of Decadence, and then we were thrown back in the studio without a single break. I don't know if it was management or the record label or our own insecurity, but we were being pushed way too hard. Somebody should have just stepped in, realized we were under too much pressure, and given us a month to dry out under the sun in the Bahamas. Vince wasn't the problem. He was just the scapegoat. But the thing about Motley Crue is that we're so full-on dragster fuel-driven that as soon as we saw the green light, we put the pedal to the floor and shot through the gate so fast, there was no time to look back until it was too late.
Chapter 4. Doug Thaler. A last chance to avert a tragedy is unapologetically avoided. A meeting was called at Nikki's house for Wednesday morning, February 12, 1992. Chuck Shapiro, David Ruttich, and Mick, Nikki, and Tommy were there. Vince hadn't called anyone that night, and he hadn't been invited. Maybe I should have called him. But I didn't know what to say to him because I hadn't been filled in yet on exactly what was going on. We tried to discourage the band from getting rid of Vince. They'd just been given their $25 million contract, and if Elektra chose to, it could exercise one of its options and renege on the deal if Vince left, and that would screw up all of their careers. But Tommy and Nikki insisted. They were sick of Vince and couldn't take it anymore. They took a vote, and it was unanimous. Vince was gone. I drove to the office, told the staff what had happened, and sat down at my desk. A few minutes later, the phone rang. A guy named Tony introduced himself and said he was a prominent attorney and co-owner of the Roxy. Your client, Vince Neil, was in my nightclub on Saturday night for his birthday, Tony began, upset. He went on to explain that Vince had been with Robert Patrick, the actor who plays the half-man, half-mercury villain in Terminator 2, and a fight had broken out that looked like something out of a western. Tables went flying, glasses were broken, and Vince was in the middle of it, breaking a bottle and slicing the manager of the Roxy in the face. He was thrown out of the club screaming that they couldn't do this to him. So, you see my problem, Tony continued. There's a lot of damage here. It's going to take at least $50,000 to get this place up and running again, and I'd hate to press any drunken disorderly charges or vandalism charges against your client. I listened to all this and then answered, I don't know how to tell you this, but as of a couple hours ago, this is no longer my problem. I hung up the phone. And for a short while, I felt the weight of the world lift off my shoulders.
Chapter 5. Mick. Of Mick's typically terse reaction to the loss heard around the world, which in his childhood was widely believed to be a flat, non-spherical object. I forget what happened. I think Nikki got mad at Vince for being late and sent him a fax or something like that. The tension was bad, and it had been building for years. Every person in the world has good qualities and shortcomings, and I guess we started making the mistake of focusing on the shortcomings of each person instead of looking at what their best asset was and what they contributed to the band. When Vince came to rehearsal, he was prissy mad, and Nikki was prissy mad. Though I hadn't been that happy with Vince's attitude lately either, it didn't matter whether he was at rehearsal or not. I was working on the music, and you have to get the music finished before you even think about adding the vocals. Chapter 6. John Corabi. Of the complications which ensue when an employer's wife presents our hero in training with the opportunity to transgress on one, perhaps even two, of the Lord's Ten Commandments. Steven Tyler told me I was the guy in a circus who's about to be shot out of a cannon. And that's what it felt like. I put on my crash helmet, tied my superhero cape around my neck, climbed into the barrel, and waited while three ringmasters ran around behind me and lit the fuse. While I flew through the air, there was no sensation to compare it to. It was the happiest moment of my life. But when I landed, it hurt like no pain I'd ever experienced. It began in Spin magazine. Nikki Sixx told the interviewer that he was a big fan of the first record, Let It Scream, by my band, The Scream. I was never a big Motley Crue fan. I didn't own any albums and hadn't seen any concerts, but I wanted to call him and thank him for mentioning my band. I also had an ulterior motive, to see if he wanted to write some songs with me for the next Scream record. My manager gave me the number of Doug Thaler's office. I called, and his secretary, Stephanie, answered. I introduced myself and told her I wanted to tell Nikki I appreciated the plug. I expected her to brush me off like an obsessive fan, but instead there was an awkward pause, as if she was excited that I had called. Let me get the number where you are, she stammered, and I'll make sure he gets the message. I hung up and started getting ready for our show that night in Orange County, the last of our tour with the Dangerous Toys. I left a note and flowers for my wife, Valerie, because it was Valentine's Day, and grabbed the keys to my Ford Taurus, which I still had 2 years left of payments on. As I closed the door behind me, the phone rang. I locked the door, then changed my mind, unlocked it, and raced for the receiver. Hey, what's up, man? It's Nikki Sixx. And Tommy, dude. I hadn't expected him to call back at all, let alone so soon. Hey, what's up? I asked, unsure if this was a joke or not. We made small talk for a while about the Spin article, and then Nikki cut me off. Here's the deal. You have to promise not to tell anybody this, because we haven't made an announcement yet, but Vince left the band. So Tommy and I were wondering if you'd like to come down and jam with us one day. You mean audition for you guys? Yeah, audition, whatever. Okay, man, sure. No problem. Thanks. I called my manager and asked him what I should do. He said to just play the Scream show that night and keep everything quiet until I knew what was happening. I met the band at the club, sound-checked, and told them I had talked to Nikki and thanked him for mentioning the album. That was all I said. Before the show, we drove to KNAC for an on-air interview and acoustic set. As we began the broadcast, someone handed Long Paul, the disc jockey, a piece of paper. He read it, raised his eyebrows, and announced, "We just got a fax here. It says that Motley Crue has gotten rid of Vince Neil. Can you believe that?" None of us replied. Instead, the whole band turned and stared at me. They knew something was up, but I played stupid. "Are you serious?" I asked. "They got rid of him?" 3 days later, my time had come. The audition, I had no idea how I was going to pull it off because besides my complete lack of expertise on the Crue, Vince's voice is so much higher than mine. His is high and clean, mine is dark and raspy. When I walked into the studio in Burbank, there they were, the Enigmas themselves, jamming on Angel by Jimi Hendrix. It sounded loud, dirty, and amazing. They were a tight band, and they had so much equipment in the room it looked like the Guitar Center. To break the ice, I told them that I had considered taking off my clothes and walking into the audition naked. It was a stupid comment, but Tommy laughed. "Dude, you should have done that. That would have been amazing." I exhaled and relaxed. I liked these guys. I wasn't that familiar with their songs, but I had been in more than 50 cover bands in my hometown of Philadelphia, so I knew all the covers they did. We started with Helter Skelter. I grabbed the mic, started singing, and after the first verse, they suddenly stopped playing. My lungs froze, and I waited for them to kick me out of the room. "Dude, it's just insane," Tommy said and laughed in disbelief. He liked it. We finished Helter Skelter, then plunged into more covers, Jailhouse Rock and Smokin' in the Boys' Room. They handed me the lyrics to Dr. Feelgood and Don't Go Away Mad. Tommy was giddy with excitement because it sounded so much heavier with a raspier voice and a second guitar, but Nikki and Mick stayed quiet. They said that they were rehearsing some other singers the next day, and I should come back then. When I returned for the second audition, Doug Thaler, Chuck Shapiro, and David Rudick were there. Rudick, the band's lawyer, sat me down and recited some legal mumbo-jumbo that I didn't understand, and then we powered through the same songs again. Afterward, the suits shook my hand and thanked me for coming down and acted all dry and businesslike, careful not to reveal any emotion, whether positive or negative. "Fuck," I said to the band after the suits left. "We've only been here for 45 minutes. Do you guys want to jam or something?" Nick and I traded blues phrases for a while, and then I showed them a riff I had been working on. By the end of the rehearsal, we had already written the foundation of one song, Hammered, and the acoustic portion of another, Misunderstood. Nicky had some new lyrics, so I sang them, and then took a break to go to the bathroom. When I returned, the three of them were sitting on the drum riser. "It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out," Tommy stood up and told me. "You are the guy." "But you can't let anyone know yet," Nicky said, "because there's going to be a lot of legal stuff to work out." "Can I tell my wife?" I asked them. They smiled. "Yes, of course you can tell your wife." At home, Valerie was waiting for me with some friends. Robert, the drummer in my first real band, Angora, was there with his girlfriend, Gina. And Niels Lozauer, who was actually a friend of Nicky's as well, was hanging out with his wife, Denise. They had two bottles of Dom Perignon waiting. "I've got good news and bad news," I told Valerie. "The good news is that I did the audition and it was cool. The bad news is that you're looking at the new singer of Motley Crue." Though I was joking, it actually turned out to be bad news for her. I was standing in the mouth of a lion, and we both knew it. Everything started out fine. The band sent a beautiful crystal vase with 2 dozen roses in it to Valerie the next day with a note that said, "Welcome to the family." But as rehearsals continued, I was home less and less, which was especially hard on Valerie because our son had just been diagnosed with diabetes. Nicky would show up at our one-bedroom house shit-faced after fighting with Brandy and slur, "All right, Crab, you're coming with me or you're fired." Or Tommy would pick me up in a limo in the middle of the night and we'd get tattooed together. I decided to have the name of the album, Till Death Do Us Part, carved into my arm, though soon afterward they changed the name of the album to just Motley Crue. One night, I took Valerie out with us, and she wasn't too happy when she saw all the chicks swarming around us like flies on shit. We ended up at the Mondrian Hotel and Nicky got a room for himself because he didn't want to go home. I waited in the sky bar downstairs with Valerie, who was so drunk she fell asleep. While I was in the bathroom, she woke up and thought I had gone to Nicky's room, so she went up to find me. When I returned from the bathroom, someone at the bar told me she had gone upstairs. So we chased each other all over the hotel for an hour until finally I was in Nicky's room and there was a knock at the door. The hotel security guard was standing in the hallway holding my wife. "This woman says she's married to John," he said, holding her by the neck as if she were a drunk hooker. "Should I throw her out?" "Valerie!" I yelled, and the guard released her. She flew across the room and sucker-punched me in the face. I turned scarlet with anger, grabbed her, and threw her in the car downstairs. We fought all the way home. We lived in a bad neighborhood, and people like Tommy were scared to visit because they'd hear gunfire. One evening I went to 7-Eleven to get some milk. On the way home, 3 Mexicans jumped me. One smashed me in the back of the head with his gun, and another kept stabbing me in the hand and the back with a big screwdriver. Strangely, they snatched the jewelry off my neck, but left my wallet alone. I stumbled home a bloody mess and collapsed on the living room floor. I was upset. After all that trouble, I had left the milk lying in the street. When the band heard what had happened, they loaned Valerie and me money to move to Thousand Oaks, which had much better schools for the kids. The guys also threw in a brand new Harley-Davidson Heritage Softail Classic, so that we could all go riding together. But for Valerie and me, it was already too late. I had met Valerie when I was 18 and playing in a cover band with her brother. 2 years later, we were married with a son. I spent the next 14 years being a husband and a father while moonlighting in rock bands. But standing in the mouth of the lion that was Motley, I looked into the black, yawning pit and saw a lot of crazy, decadent shit that I had been missing out on during all those years of marriage. On top of that, as the new frontman for this beast, I had to be bigger, louder, and more vicious than the rest of the guys. Neither Valerie nor I knew how to cope with what was going on, and after so many years of weathering all kinds of poverty and bad luck, we let good fortune break us up. For some reason, everyone's marriages were falling apart. Nick's, Nikki's, Tommy's, mine, and even Vince's. Just before Valerie and I broke up, we were hanging out in Catalina with the band. Within earshot of Mick, his wife, Emmy, walked over to me, grabbed my arm, and whispered something about a condominium she and Mick had in Marina Del Rey. I wasn't sure if she was trying to sublet it to me, get me to buy it for her, or invite me to spend the night there. I thanked her for the kind offer and turned away. I'd only been in the band for a month, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't want anyone to think I was hitting on one of their wives. But after that, every time I saw Emmy when she was drunk, she'd start talking about how her psychic had told her a handsome man with curly dark hair was going to come into her life. The next time I saw Tommy and Nikki, I told them, "Look, this is the opportunity of a lifetime for me, and I don't want to blow it, but I think Mick's wife is hitting on me. And I just want you to know so that if this ever becomes a problem between Mick and me, you'll know that I'm innocent as far as his wife is concerned." Mick's marriage didn't last long after that. He is one of the sweetest people I have ever met in the music business, but because he's so nice and never wants to make trouble, he usually ends up getting fucked over. In the case of Emmy, she had a band called Alice in Thunderland, and Mick bought them Marshall stacks, bass cabinets, a new drum kit, a flying V for the guitarist, and plenty of studio time. Then, while he was in Vancouver working on the Motley record, he started to suspect that his wife was sleeping with the guitarist he had just bought the flying V for. Mick was so passive that when his wife asked if she could permanently move into that condo by the beach in Marina Del Rey, he gave it to her. But he stayed in his old place, and I moved into the guest house because I had finally separated from Valerie. Emmy seemed to want everything Mick had to give, but his most valuable possession, himself. Ready to begin the new album, we flew Bob Rock down to L.A. to start talking about ideas. On the day of the meeting, however, I couldn't reach anyone in the band. I drove to Tommy's house with my son and saw Nikki's car in the driveway, so I figured the meeting was going on without me. When no one answered the buzzer, I climbed over the fence and pounded on the door. Finally, Tommy and Nikki appeared, and they were hammered. All you could see on Nikki was black hair and a row of grinning white teeth. "Fuck, bro, what are you doing here?" Tommy asked. "What's going on with the meeting?" I asked. "Aw, dude, we're just like waiting for Bob Rock to get here." It turned out that the night before, Nikki and Tommy were out with their wives. They had a glass of wine together, then decided to smoke some pot. One thing led to another, and they ended up sending their wives away while they called up their old dealer for 2 8-balls and fiended all night, cooking up cocaine in Nikki's closet until they passed out. When Rock showed up around 1 in the afternoon, his eyes bulged out of his head in horror. When he had last seen Tommy and Nikki, they were sober, but now they reeked of alcohol, their noses were runny from cocaine, and they couldn't even form a sentence. When Nikki left the meeting and passed out on the couch in the next room, Rock threw up his hands. There was no way he was going to do this record, he said, unless the band got its act together. When he left, he blew the whistle to Thaler and Bob Timmons, who came running to the rescue. But fortunately, it was just a one-day binge, a planned slip. Nikki and Tommy just needed to get it out of their systems, though I don't know if their wives ever really forgave them.
Chapter 7. Tommy. How adventures concerning nude beaches and wandering eyes lead to lost love for our tender-hearted hero. It fucking happens every time. A chick starts dating me because she sees this tattooed rocker dude leading a wild, crazy, unpredictable existence, and she falls in love with that lifestyle. But over time, she starts to disapprove of what I am and tries to change it. Anyone who falls in love with me needs to realize that music is fucking number one. When you say that to a girl, she wonders if that means that she's number two. No, man. Heather was number one also. I had two number ones, and any girl I meet has to get used to riding shotgun with me and the music. Because I need a partner, not a leader. So hang with me and my music, and we will be all lovely. But that's not what happened with Heather. It was the typical celebrity marriage. At first, we thought that it was perfect because we were both experiencing fame and pressure, and thought that we could only settle down with someone who understood our jobs and was as busy as we were. But by the end, our narcissism and obsession with our careers got in the way. It was hard for me to get her to relax in public. When we cruised around the Greek islands, the first thing I wanted to do was chill on a nude beach. So we go there, and I stripped down and plunged into the water. I ran back, and she was still standing there with her swimsuit on this beautiful island full of naked people. She was so worried there'd be a photographer hiding in the rocks, and maybe she was right, but at the time, I didn't give a fuck if there was. In many ways, I felt inhibited around her. She threw a fit whenever I fell off the wagon, which maybe made sense, too, and she absolutely refused to let me get a big tattoo back piece that I wanted. I felt especially trapped because she wanted me to settle down, but at the same time, didn't want to go through with the other obligations of settling down. Nikki had a baby with a second on the way. Vince had three kids with three separate women. And Nick was already a fucking grandfather. I loved kids. I wanted to have one so badly with Heather, but every time she said no. She was concerned about her career and couldn't afford to be pregnant. Besides, she didn't seem to be that into kids. Whenever they came by, she'd get worked up because they were jumping on the furniture or had chocolate on their hands. Maybe she was too young or not at the right point in her life, or maybe she didn't want to have kids with someone like me, a theory that really nagged at me when she got pregnant right after hooking up with Richie Sambora. But I started to get bummed. I'd invested a lot of years in the relationship, and if there wasn't any chance of it moving forward, it was best to cut my losses. When I was born, my dad was already so old that he could hardly play ball with me. I wanted to be young enough to run around with my kids, have the same interests, keep up with them, and be a part of their lives until they grew up. When I'm in love, I have fucking blinders on. I don't even look at other women. But once I started reassessing my marriage with Heather, just as I'm sure she was reassessing me, my eyes started drifting. And after your eyes start drifting, your mind starts drifting. And after your mind starts drifting, your hands start drifting. And after your hands start drifting, it's all bad forever after. And we lasted through 7 years of craziness, through the ups and downs of both our careers, through my mad drug and alcohol abuse and the fucking torture of rehab, through the crazy-ass success of Dr. Feelgood. And there's something to be said for that. We made it pretty long, considering. Strangely, after Heather and I split up, a couple of drunk assholes kicked the shit out of Karabi and me while we were walking down the street. As I was lying in a hotel bed recuperating, there was a noise at my door, and I looked up to find Honey letting herself into the room. It was the first time I had seen her in 9 years. She walked to the bed, bent over, gave me a blowjob, and left without a word. I haven't seen her since. As I lay there, confused and empty afterward, I realized just how lonely I was without Heather. Because after 7 years of marriage, you look around for your friends and realize they're long gone. But at the same time, I was excited. I was excited to fall in love again, not with another girl, but with music. There was a whole new school of bands coming out, hard, heavy shit like Pantera and Prong. And with Vince gone and a tattooed dirtbag like Karabi in, we finally had the tools to get into some real shit.
Chapter 8. John Karabi. A freshman, hazed by his seniors, discovers their true nature after a night of humiliation at the hands of the town harlots. After Tommy and Nikki's binge, they committed themselves to sobriety so that they could try to repeat the success of Dr. Feelgood with Bob Rock in Vancouver. For them, there was no middle ground. Not only were alcohol and drugs forbidden, but so were red meat, cigarettes, and caffeine. We popped vitamins all day and worked out mornings with a trainer. But unavoidably, there were nights when we fell off the wagon. The first time was when Snake from Skid Row came up to visit us. Tommy, Nikki, Snake, and I hit a strip club and then a local bar. Nikki, who was already obliterated, asked the waitress how much the kamikazes were. She told him they were $3.50, so he reached into his pocket, handed her a fistful of bills, and said, "As much money as here, that's how many kamikazes I want." 15 minutes later, a group of waitresses walked up with 9 trays of kamikazes and arranged them on the table. We pounded them until we couldn't drink anymore and climbed into the band van. "Crab," Tommy asked me, "have you ever been with a hooker?" "No," I stammered. "Well, let's get you a hooker then." Life was so normal and easy when these guys were sober, but when they were fucked up, they'd squeeze a whole lifetime of adventure, mayhem, and decadence into a 12-hour span. On the way to Richard Street, where the prostitutes hung out, we pooled our money. I had $100, Tommy had $80, poor Snake had $600, and Nikki had $12 left over from his kamikaze binge. We pulled 4 really cute hookers into the van and took them back to the hotel to party. Tommy hooked the girls up with some weed, Nikki pulled out a couple bottles of Jack, and we started partying. Tommy was separated from Heather but wanted to call her and check in anyway. "When I come back," he said, "this party is going to fucking start." A half hour later, he pushed open the door and walked in with his pants around his ankles, yelling at the top of his lungs and bum-rushing one of the prostitutes. At that exact moment, one particularly bitchy hooker looked at her watch and said, "That'll be another $200 each." All of a sudden, the party went quiet, and the kind of dark, somber cloud that appears whenever anyone mentions money hung over the room. "What do you mean, $200? I asked. "It's been an hour, and it's $200 an hour." Nikki went ballistic. He threw his Jack Daniels bottle across the room, and it shattered on the wall over the bitchy hooker. He ran after her, threatening to slice her in half. And faster than you can say, "Don't go away mad," the room was girl-free. There were just the 4 of us left, sitting on the couch. The hookers had left with all our weed and money, and Nikki had thrown our last bottle of Jack against the wall. Snake popped open a beer from the minibar and shook his head. "Dudes, what just happened?" he asked. Then he smiled wickedly. "Yeah, the bad boys of rock and roll, Motley Crue and Skid Row, just had to pay girls $800 to talk to us. We're pathetic." Unbeknownst to me, Tommy and Nikki had decided that the night was not over. While Snake kept me busy with small talk, they snuck into the hotel kitchen and stole a 50-gallon vat of tomato sauce. Then they swiped my room key from the front desk, pulled the sheet back from my bed, covered my mattress with tomato sauce, and remade the bed. When I returned to my room that night, I noticed that it smelled like spaghetti, but didn't think anything of it. I pulled back the sheet and put my hand down on the bed, and it squelched in something. I looked at my hand, and it was covered with red like something out of The Exorcist. I was so drunk, however, that I thought if I ignored the tomato sauce, that would somehow show Tommy and Nikki that they hadn't gotten the better of me. So I went to sleep in it. The next morning, I left a box with 12 cream puffs outside Nikki's door and rang the bell. He opened the door, looked down the hall, then noticed the cream puffs. An hour later, I saw the empty cream puff box in the hallway. Then at the gym later that day, I watched him explain to the trainer why he felt too sluggish to do any of the exercises. After that, it was all out war with Nikki. He would take me out to a bar and get me drunk. Then, while I was talking to a girl, he'd take a taxi back to the hotel, fill my keyhole with Elmer's glue and broken matchsticks, and return to the bar. Once I was good and drunk, he'd bring me back home and watch out of his peephole while the hotel staff took my door off the hinges so I could crash for the night. I retaliated by putting a blow-up love doll on Nikki's door with a sign that said, "Welcome, sailors," and posting notices all over the hotel inviting single men to his room. Then Nikki pulled out all the stops. While I was sleeping, he spent several hours gluing an entire room service tray to my door, sticking on every plate, napkin, utensil, and even filling a glass with Elmer's glue so that it looked like milk. Then he doused my whole door with hairspray, set it on fire, knocked, and ran back to his room. Mick was always too smart for anyone to pull pranks on. He covered the hallway leading up to his room with flour so that he could track the footprints of anyone who dared to mess with him. That year was probably the best time of my life. Everyone was on new territory creatively and just having stupid, harmless fun. Mick had never worked with a second guitarist, Nicky had never worked with a second lyricist, and the band had never written songs through just jamming. We couldn't wait for Motley fans to hear what we'd done. We thought we had really made an intelligent Motley Crue record with a lot of commentary on the kooky shit going on in the world, from the Rodney King riots in L.A. to the latest fury over music censorship. The last song I wrote for the record was called Uncle Jack, which was about a relative of mine who had sexually molested my brothers and sisters. Just as we started recording, he was arrested and charged with statutory rape and sexual assault of 20 young children, all of which he had documented with pictures. But 2 months later, he was let out of jail because the wardens and the court were worried that the other inmates were going to kill him. So now that he was free, where did he find a new job? A Catholic elementary school. As we were finishing the record, my mother called and told me he had been arrested again. While teaching at the Catholic school, he had moved in with a woman and her 2 sons, aged 8 and 3. She worked at night, and he worked during the day, so he spent most of his time unsupervised with them. After just a few months, the woman he was living with was killed in a car accident. When her ex-husband moved back into the house, he discovered that the guy had been sodomizing both boys. I was livid when I found out that he was still destroying all these people's lives, so Nicky said, "Why don't you want to write a song about it?" I wanted to release the song as a single and donate the money to Centers for Abused Children. We were ready to make a difference and show the world that Motley Crue was still a circus, but a circus with a heart. When we finished the record, we went on a press tour. Everywhere we traveled, fans went berserk. In Milan, a group of contest winners attacked me and started tearing off pieces of my clothing for souvenirs. I looked over at Nicky. "Get ready for it, Crab," he beamed. "It's going to be like this all the time."
Chapter 9. Vince. Alone in the world, poor Vince flees into the arms of playmates, pets, and primetime actresses, and learns that life could not be better. It was a perfect time for a midlife crisis. I just turned 30, which didn't seem that old, but all these younger rock bands were appearing and I was beginning to feel like a dinosaur. On top of that, I'd just been kicked out of the band I'd spent the last 10 years with, and I had left my wife. Ever since Charisse and I had moved into a huge mansion in Simi Valley to raise our daughter, Skylar, our fighting had escalated, most memorably on my birthday when she caught Robert Patrick and me talking with a future porn star named Lene at the Roxy and hit me in the nose with a glass, which started a complete ruckus that ended with both of us kicked out of the club. I'd begged Doug a long time for help. I told him that I was having a lot of problems between my wife and my confusion over feeling aged out of rock music at 30. I explained to him that I was badly in need of help. If the band was upset at me for missing rehearsals, I wanted them to understand that it had nothing to do with them. I loved Motley Crue. I would have done anything for them. I don't know if Doug ever told the band about our conversation, because the next thing I knew, after our fight at rehearsal during the rainstorm, Doug was calling my house and saying, "The band doesn't want you around anymore. I'm willing to release you from your management contract tonight if you want." I was stunned. I expected that we'd cool off for a week, then I'd get a call from Nicky and we'd start working together again. I just muttered, "Okay," and hung up. I didn't know what else to say. If Doug had been more than a yes man, he could have saved the band. All he had to say was, "Come back and let's talk about it. We will get you a counselor and talk about your problems." Clearly what I was going through wasn't a drinking problem, but a mental problem that was leading to drinking and skipping rehearsal. But instead, he called and fired me and told me not to speak to anyone in the band. That was it. What could I do after that kind of treatment? I had 2 choices. I could kill myself, or I could go to Hawaii with a stripper and get over it. I chose the latter. I grabbed the first chick I could find, a porn star named Savannah, and took her to Hawaii. She was a gorgeous platinum blonde with soft, perfect curves. Despite the fact that a million guys are jacking off to her movies every day, she was extremely insecure, like a lost little girl. With the band out of my hair, I couldn't see any reason to stay sober, so we brought all the pills and coke we could carry with us. After staying up for 4 days straight at the Maui Hilton, Savannah took one pill too many and dropped to the floor convulsing. I called an ambulance and followed her to the hospital. I'd never seen anyone look so beautiful and innocent while lying overdosed in a stretcher. When she returned to the hotel the next day, we picked up right where we had left off and started partying again. But I was older, and for some reason, not only could I not get as fucked up as I used to, but I couldn't recover as quickly. By the time I returned to L.A., I was a mess. I flew to the clinic in Tucson again to dry out. Savannah sent me a different porno picture of herself every day until the sober police found my stash and busted me. By the time I completed treatment, she was dating Pauly Shore. Several years later, she asked me to be her date to the Adult Video News Porno Awards in Las Vegas. I told her I'd go with her, but at the last minute, blew her off for another girl. A few days later, they found her dead in her garage. She had disfigured herself in a car crash that day, then gone home, pulled out a Beretta, and shot herself in the head. She had a lot of other problems in her life then, and I knew the reason wasn't because I had stood her up, but I felt terrible. Where most of the girls in her line of work are just gold diggers, she was never like that. She just wanted somebody to love her. Savannah was the beginning of my descent into Hollywood Babylon. I hadn't really hung out on the scene since we all lived together in the Motley House and ruled the strip. We thought we were on top of the world, and though we were far from it, we were much happier in our ignorance. Hollywood 10 years later was a different place. Leaving Charisse and Skylar in our Simi Valley house, I moved in with Rob Lowe, who had a bachelor pad in the Hollywood Hills. We'd become friends because we were both attending Monday night sobriety meetings for celebrities, which was probably the most cliched place a pair like us could meet. We were a tabloid dream team. The bad boy lead singer from Motley Crue and a preppy actor sex symbol who had just been busted in a videotape menage a trois with a 16-year-old girl. Since Rob and his girlfriend had recently broken up for obvious reasons, the two of us went crazy. I'd take him to the Rainbow to have his pick of rock groupies, and he'd take me to decadent film parties at huge mansions in the Hollywood Hills and Bel Air. Our place was always full of chicks, just like the Motley House used to be, except this place was clean. On weekends, I'd get to play with Skylar, which I needed as much as she did because it was my only break from the vortex of abandon that Rob and I were being sucked into. After 6 months, Rob's bachelor life ended when his former girlfriend moved back into the house. By then, I'd found a manager, Bruce Bird, who put me in the studio with Tommy Shaw and Jack Blades to write a song for the soundtrack to a Pauly Shore vehicle called Encino Man. That pretty much blew Nikki and Tommy's theory that I didn't care about music anymore, because they hadn't even released a thing yet. I kept that insult in mind when I sued them for 25% of their future profits and $5 million in damages. It was the gentlemanly thing to do, my lawyer said. My attorney also closed a $4 million deal for me at Warner Brothers, where Mo Austin said, "You know what we should do? We should take Vince and that other rock kid we've got, David Lee Roth, and put them in a band together." "But Dad," his son Michael protested, "they're both singers." I still didn't really know what to do with myself. I had no home and hadn't put together a real band yet. So I moved into the plush Bellage Hotel. They let me park my 3 Ferraris, Rolls Royce, and motorcycle there. I told you I was going through a midlife crisis. And gave me full run of their restaurant, the Diaghilev, after hours. Since I was hanging out drinking all the time anyway, I decided that I might as well do it in my own club. So me and some buddies bought into a snooty Beverly Hills night spot called Bar One, which was conveniently across the street from the hotel. It had a 5-star restaurant on one side of the room and a bar and dance floor on the other. Paparazzi were always lined up outside trolling for celebrities. Pretty soon I forgot about Motley Crue. There was too much of Bar One to distract me. It was a great place to meet people. I'd have dinner with Sylvester Stallone or make out with Tori Spelling and Shannon Doherty in the private back room. I watched Gone with the Wind for the first time with Shannon at my house because she was supposed to play the book's author, Margaret Mitchell, in a movie. though all I could think about was putting my dick up her ass because we were on the couch and the thing was practically lying in there. We ended up as good friends, and I let her husband of 5 months, Ashley Hamilton, play at the club. After Shannon, I had a few dates with Vanessa Marcille from General Hospital. We went to see Les Miserables or something. Then I met Christy Turlington at the bar and took her to Las Vegas for the opening of a casino. I happened to run into Tommy Lee there, and we sort of nodded heads and exchanged a smile. At the time, Christy was on my lap and I was teaching her how to play roulette. But nothing ever came of it because I got so fucked up that I passed out and some friends had to carry me up to my room. As soon as I returned to L.A., I met a playmate and actress named Pamela Anderson at Bar One. It turned out that her brother had washed some of my sports cars because he ran a car detailing service. Pam was on Home Improvement at the time, so she took me on our first date to see Tim Allen's stand-up routine. Pamela was dating a lot of people, and so was I. Since I was shooting a video for a solo song I'd recorded, Can't Have Your Cake, I put Pamela in the clip along with Skylar and three girls I was dating at the same time, though none of them knew it. I guess I was trying to make the point that sometimes you can have your cake and eat it too, though I'd soon find out that wasn't true at all. After a few more dates with me, Pamela moved on to Brett Michaels of Poison, and I got started on a playmate jag. In the current Playboy issue, the centerfold had listed as one of her ambitions, "Someday I want to marry a rock star." That same month, Hugh Hefner was having his annual Midsummer Night's Dream party, at which everyone has to show up in sleep attire. Lingerie for the girls, bathrobes for the men. I put on a silk robe and boxer shorts and drove to the party in my Testarossa. My mission was straightforward and simple. I walked into the party, found the centerfold, and said, "I'm your rock star." She was wearing a white teddy with stockings and looked unbelievable. She looked at me and smiled. "Come on, we're wasting time," I continued. "Let's get out of here." We left the party and went to Bar One with our bedclothes still on. By the end of the night, she was so smashed she was dancing on the pool table in her negligee. I took her back to the hotel and tried to take her up to my room. "No," she screamed, "I want to drive the Ferrari first." I sighed and gave her the keys. She pulled out of the hotel, drove on to Sunset, then turned south on San Vicente Boulevard. As she began to turn onto Fountain, she suddenly gummed the gas. I guess she wanted to see how fast the car could accelerate, but you don't do that when you're rounding a corner. The car spun a full 360 degrees and slammed into a truck crossing the intersection. The truck knocked the car into a northbound lane on San Vicente, and my centerfold freaked out and tried to speed away. She made it about 5 feet before she plowed into a van, which completed the devastation of my Ferrari. She crawled out of the car in her underwear and staggered to the curb. I walked out, looked at the smoke rising from the scrap heap that was once my pride and joy, and started cursing her out, calling her every name I could think of as I stood there with my boxer shorts flapping in the wind. She burst into tears, crying until the police showed up and hauled her off to jail for DUI. She looked ravishing in the leather back seat of the cop car, handcuffed in her lingerie with her blonde hair, a tangled mess, her face streaked with makeup. Another cop car drove me back to the Bellage. I changed my clothes, bailed her out, brought her back to the hotel, and finally got laid. We were so bonded by the events of that night that we dated for a little while after that. And I learned that she wasn't actually the kind of girl who destroyed everything she touched. She just destroyed everything she touched that belonged to me. Amidst all this chaos, I quickly and painlessly completed my first album, Exposed, at the Record Plant with Steve Stevens of Billy Idol's band on lead guitar, who had just left a group with Mike Monroe of Hanoi, Vicky Fox of Enough's Enough on drums, Dave Marshall on rhythm guitar, and on bass, Robbie Crane, who used to work sound on porn movies. Eventually, I fired Fox and hired Randy Castillo, the crazy long-haired rocker who, since coming to my mud wrestling parties, had made a reputation for himself playing with the Motels and Lita Ford, and more recently, Tommy had hooked him up with Ozzy Osbourne. While I was working on some drum tracks with Ron Nevison, we received an unexpected phone call. My manager, Bruce, had collapsed with a brain aneurysm. In our short time together, I'd grown to love Bruce like a father. Ron and I walked to a nearby bar, loaded up on drinks while crying on each other's shoulders, then went to the hospital to visit him. We arrived too late. He was dead. When a mutual friend, Bert Stein, heard what had happened, He offered to help out until I found a new manager. He never stopped managing me, and together, we bonded through more dark days and deaths than we ever thought could be possible in a lifetime. When I returned to the studio, someone brought in a vivid video porn star named Janine Lindemulder, who I started dating and later cast in one of my videos. Every model who appeared in one of my solo videos was someone I was dating. As soon as we finished the album, I brought her and a friend of mine, a penthouse pet, to Hawaii to celebrate. One of them brought a video camera, and when we were all fucked up one night, set it up and taped the action. After the trip, I never saw either girl again until I took a trip to Palm Springs months later. They were both there and dating each other. I had hooked them up. You'd be surprised how often that happens. I didn't think anything about the two of them until years later, when after the Pamela and Tommy home video leaked out, my tape was suddenly on the market. I thought that Janine had sold it for money because I never had a copy. I was pissed at her, but refrained from suing her or calling her out publicly because I didn't want to draw any more attention to the sex tape. Fortunately, I didn't do anything because I later found out through the tape's distributor that the other girl had leaked it, which made sense when I finally watched the video, because her face had been blurred out. After Palm Springs, I started checking out a club called Denim and Diamonds, where bikers and models mixed. And I decided that Bar One should have a night like that. We talked Jägermeister into sponsoring the event and bringing in the Jägermeister girls. I had never tasted Jägermeister before, so I had no idea how potent it was. I don't remember much of what happened later that night. I somehow walked outside, climbed on my Harley, and rode down the pavement into the door of the club. The place was completely packed, and as I revved up the bike and cruised onto the dance floor, the wheel slipped out from under me and the bike hit the floor and slid into a row of tables. I landed on my back on the dance floor and passed out. I woke up, sick, embarrassed, and thankful I hadn't killed anyone or myself. I don't think I'd ever been that out of control on liquor before. I lay in bed sweating and vomiting for 2 days with alcohol poisoning. That ended my midlife crisis. I couldn't go on behaving like that anymore. I had to grow up and accept the fact that I was an adult with responsibilities, though of course that didn't mean I still couldn't have fun. I moved out of the Bellage and bought my own home, a huge gothic-looking house called Sea Manor in Malibu. Not only did I need to get out of Hollywood, but I wanted a place that Skylar would enjoy. Visiting me in Hollywood was never much fun for her. I set up a room in the house for her with a little desk and a kiddie computer. She loved visiting the house. And every morning dragged me out of bed and onto the beach, where we'd make sandcastles as tall as her, and spend hours telling stories about the kings and queens and rock stars who lived in them. In the quiet of Malibu, I also put together a new band to promote Exposed. The album had hit number 13 on the pop charts, so we landed our first tour opening up for Van Halen. It was a humbling experience because I hadn't opened for anyone in years, and because I was touring with the band that had replaced its lead singer and was doing pretty well. Sammy Hagar, who was filling in for David Lee Roth, quickly became a good friend, and we put ourselves on a schedule of downing kamikazes before my show and margaritas before his. He ended up with the short end of the deal because he was always wasted before he hit the stage. After leaving the Sheds with Van Halen, we headlined a club tour on our own, which was even more humbling because I hadn't played in places that small since Rock Candy. Now that I was solo, I had to do all the interviews, write all the songs, make up the set lists, figure out the marketing, approve all the artwork, and deal with everything. I learned more on that album and tour than in my entire time with Motley. But the grind quickly wore me down, and as soon as I found an opportunity to get off the road, I retreated to the comfort of Malibu and Skylar. My house was the most opulent place I'd ever lived in, with a spiral staircase running through the center topped by a dome of stained glass. It looked like the perfect setting for a porn movie, so I started renting it out for porn shoots and for penthouse centerfold shoots when my daughter wasn't around. Afterward, I'd get to date the pets. Life reverted to the time before I met Charisse, and I was playing at being a mini Hugh Hefner. I'd invite my buddies over all the time, and we'd kick back and watch the shoots. If the crew was cool, we'd throw beach parties, and neighbors like John Lovitz and Charlie Miner would come by. On one of the penthouse shoots, there was a makeup artist named Alexis who also worked on the big Playboy shoots. She was showing me her Polaroids, and a chill ran through my body when I saw the cover model for the April issue of Playboy. She was as skinny, blonde, and big-titted as could be, and that was all I needed to see. I have to meet this girl, I told Alexis. Alexis couldn't promise anything because the girl was an actress from Palm Beach. But soon after, she came to town and was staying at the Playboy Mansion. She called me, introduced herself as Heidi Mark, and said she could go out with me that night but had to be back early for a 7 a.m. photo shoot. I picked her up at the Playboy Mansion and took her to a friend's birthday party. I was amazed when Heidi wasn't disgusted watching us toss $100 bills at strippers like confetti. She was a tomboy, trapped in the shell of a Barbie doll, and she enjoyed the whole spectacle. Afterward, I offered to drive her back to Hef's, but she said, I don't really need to go back there. Ever since Hef's been married, the mansion's been dead. But what about the 7 a.m. photo shoot? I asked. I sort of made that up in case I didn't like you. She smiled. We went to my house, and she stayed there for a week until she had to leave for Orlando to tape a show called Thunder in Paradise. Our second date was in the Bahamas. Michael Peters, who owns the Pure Platinum chain of strip clubs, had become a good buddy of mine. Back when we were recording the single Girls, 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 I had played it for him in his Lamborghini, and he promised on the spot that the song would be played every hour on the hour in every club he owned, and he has kept that promise to this day. After my week in L.A. with Heidi, Michael and I flew 15 girls, each smuggling baggies of coke in whatever orifice they could hide them, in two Lear jets to a place called Hurricane Hole, where he had a 90-foot yacht anchored and a film crew hired to document it all. On day three, I was cruising across the bay in a wave runner with a topless blonde on the back when I happened to glance toward the beach. Sitting there on top of a pile of luggage, with her arms folded angrily over her chest, was a girl who looked very familiar. It was Heidi. I had forgotten that she was arriving that day. Instinctively, I jabbed my elbow back and knocked the blonde off the back of the wave runner and then sped to the beach. I thought somehow, when she saw me arrive alone, she'd think the topless blonde was a trick the 3 p.m. sunshine had played on her eyes. After a few days of hanging out with nude women on Michael's boat, Heidi decided that if we were to have anything resembling a healthy relationship, we would have to find somewhere to stay on our own. So we moved into a house Michael owned and used it as a love shack until, a few days later, my jet ski hit a coral reef and I flew over the top, cracking two ribs on the hard coral. Our relationship pretty quickly became one disaster after another. After the Bahamas, Michael took it upon himself to butter up Heidi's father. So we looked up the address of her father's office in Palm Beach and sent him a motherload of paraphernalia from the dollhouse, pure platinum and solid gold. Everything from t-shirts to soft porn videos of the girls. He'd been in the business for so long, he thought that any red-blooded male would be glad to receive his stripper gifts. Unfortunately, he didn't know that Heidi's dad was a divorce lawyer, and her grandmother worked as the receptionist in his office. When the old lady opened it, she had a fit. To make matters worse, Michael had enclosed a note with the package that read, Dear John, thank you for raising such a great girl. Love, Michael. So Heidi's whole family thought she was dating Michael. When they read in the local papers that Michael had gotten arrested for violating the RICO Anti-Racketeering Act in Florida for drugs, money laundering, and liquor license violations, they practically disowned her. The only good that came out of it was that when they discovered Heidi was dating me, they were actually relieved. Now that my single life was over, I pulled out of Bar One. My partners went on to start the only strip club to get a license to operate in Beverly Hills, the Beverly Club. Instead, I spent my time with Heidi at a Malibu restaurant called Moonshadows, where Fran Drescher, Gary Busey, and Kelsey Grammer all hung out. Everything began to return to normal, except for my mail. Once a week, I'd receive a manila envelope that contained a photograph of me and Heidi lying out by the pool or in bed. I thought we were being stalked by a jealous fan until Heidi told me that her ex-fiancé had been a vice cop and was sending DEA helicopters to spy on us. I interpreted this as a warning and flushed all the cocaine I could find in the house. My contact at Warner Brothers, Michael Austin, hooked me up with a pair of producers who called themselves the Dust Brothers for my next album. They had made a great album with the Beastie Boys, but had not yet struck pay dirt with Beck and Hanson, and it was very frustrating working with them. I would record something with one of them while the other left the room to smoke pot. When we were through, the guy who had left would return and say what we did sucked. Then they'd switch places and we'd go through the same routine again. It was like trying to make an album with Cheech and Chong. They weren't into songs or production at all. They were computer cut-and-paste guys, so that whatever I finished when I left the studio one night would sound completely different the next morning. It was a frustrating experience. But somehow, as if by the magic of the marijuana fairy, we ended up with a pretty cool album. 8 years before Kid Rock and Limp Bizkit, it mixed rap beats with rock guitars. And because no one was making any music like that at the time, Warner Brothers didn't know what to do with it. As they were deciding, drama struck in the executive suites and a power struggle resulted in massive firings. Suddenly, I was at the label with nobody on my side, and a completed record with a release date that kept getting pushed back month after month. I was ready to hit the road again, but I was stuck in limbo. I'd become obsessed with racing since leaving the band, so I plunged myself into that world. I'd driven half a season in the Indy Lights and loved it. The focus, the fans, and the rush were like being on stage at a rock concert. If you made a mistake, everybody saw it. At the Long Beach Grand Prix, a car hit me on the third lap. My car swerved sideways and the wing hit the wall, snapping the bracket that holds it to the chassis. In the pit, the crew took off the wing, which is what keeps the car's back end from flying off the ground when you drive, and I tried to finish the race without it. I cruised out of the pit, down the straightaway, and as I hit a kink in the road, flipped into third gear. Instantly, the car spun out of control and slammed into the wall. The crowd roared, and I stumbled out unharmed except for the red flush of humiliation on my face. The team I was driving for was called Pig Racing, and it was mostly made up of cops and former cops. The crew consisted of guys from their SWAT team, and I had put millions of dollars into my cars and engines and a trailer. One day, one of the officers who ran the team disappeared, and I received a notice that he'd been arrested for selling coke out of the police evidence locker, which was probably how he funded the team and gone bankrupt. So everything I had was seized. I never saw my cars again, though I later saw him hanging around the races. After finishing the album with the Dust Brothers, I began driving in the amateur celebrity races. That April, after celebrating my daughter Skylar's 4th birthday, I went to Long Beach to drive in the Grand Prix again. I finished in 2nd place and came off the track exhilarated. That night, there was a party at the hotel where most of the drivers were staying, and I started to celebrate. An hour into the debauchery, a hotel staff member ran up to me. He said I had a phone call in the lobby. I picked it up, expecting Heidi. I wanted so badly to tell her how well I had raced. But it wasn't Heidi calling at all. It was my estranged wife, Charisse, and she was crying so hard she could hardly complete a sentence. Skylar's in the hospital. She struggled between sobs to expel each word. Her appendix exploded. She wants her daddy. Chapter 10. Doug Thaler. Of the battle between optimism and pessimism, and the inevitable victor.